So,
Hello, welcome back to another episode of the Self Development with Tactics podcast. Today we're gonna talk about How Minds Change by David McRaney. It's been a while, but we are back. I'm excited. And this is a rather new post. I actually do not really know if I've already went through it to some degree, so this is why I'd like to go from the back to the very front of this quote unquote summary. It's not really a summary, but yeah, I'm excited, and we will see the little bit of, well, preface, whatever, by Derek Sivers. The psychology of how and why we believe, how we learn and change, the craft of doubt and persuasion, insights into the social definition of truth. Epistemology, whatever this is, certainty is a feeling not based on facts. Well written with a nice balance of storytelling and deeper dives. So apparently, it is quite the good read. Because when Siva says that it is a good read, it probably is one. Which, I mean, I don't know. In terms of critics, because there are many types of critics, I'd say. When it comes to movies, when it comes to books, when it comes to whatever it is. And on the other hand, there are, well, influencers, I'd say, and people that have an opinion, and those people have apparently people that listen to them. I think critics are good. I guess we need them. By the way, also games, I forgot about them. But in the end, I think it also makes sense to maybe not listen to them at first and maybe come back to them. I believe, and this might be something for me, this might not really apply to you, but I do not see things as somebody else sees it. I do not recognize things that easily when it comes to especially movies. People being like, okay, the music was amazing, the soundtrack was great, and I'm like, well, I didn't even listen to it, I haven't heard, or at least consciously heard, the soundtrack, so I cannot really say if it is good or bad or whatever it might be. So in terms of this, might be good to listen to some critics, might be good to go and read through some reviews and whatever, but this might get you into some sort of a predisposition in terms of, okay, this critic said this, maybe well-known critic said that this movie is shit, and so I'll watch it, and maybe in the back of my head I'm having this critic's words, and therefore also think that it might be bad. Well, anyway, let's stop with this little rant, and let's head into the book, How Minds Change. For science to work, you must be willing to say you are wrong. This is why we invented science in the first place. Science is smarter than scientists, and the method is what delivers results over time. Most people strongly reject the notion of randomness. They would rather believe the world turned out the way it did because that's the way it was supposed to turn out. Which I really don't believe in. I think it, I don't know, it wouldn't work, I'd say. I really think it is random. My point of view, a lot of things are quite random and or just a lot of coincidences. For an idea to spread across a network in such a way that it flips almost everyone from thinking in one way to thinking in another, you don't need thought leaders or elites. The crucial factor is the susceptibility of the network. If there are enough connected people with low thresholds across groups, any shock, any person can start a cascade that will flip the majority of the population. Probably well, not well-minded, but same-minded, equally minded people, something like this. I guess you know what I mean. Would at least make sense, the more people we have that kind of think in the same way as we are doing or I'm doing and whatever, the easier it is for me to, maybe come up with something that might change their mind or that might move them to do whatever. Now imagine the psychology behind classrooms and house parties. Two previous examples here, taking place within clusters of people throughout a culture, persuading groups of friends and co-workers to quit smoking. A cascade of change can spread culture-wide. Innovation researcher Greg Settle in his book Cascades, which might also be worth reading, you know. Social gatherings like parties often empty out without any group coordination. One person who is tired or bored leaves, but if there are other tired people with low threshold, an early leaver can encourage them to do the same. And I think when it comes to clapping, you know, after a movie and hopefully not after a flight, I think just one has to start and then somebody else also follows and joins in as well. There is kind of a phenomenon around first aid and helping people in public, and apparently the more people we have, the less likely they all are to help somebody that needs the help. And I do assume that when somebody starts helping, a lot of people would also join in to also help. But there is like apparently a really big threshold to starting this first aid act. For whatever reason, you know, one would have to read into that. But imagine a group of people who needs to get into a college classroom. The classroom is empty, but the first person who shows up decides not to attempt to open the door and check. The next person who shows up doesn't want to make small talk with a stranger or make a fool of himself, so also waits. Now a third person shows up. Normally, she would have no problem checking to see if the classroom was empty, but since there are two people already waiting, she assumes they know something she doesn't and bases her behavior on their behavior. She ignores her internal signal thanks to the strength of the external one. Now we have a cascade beginning to unfold. Each person decides to adopt the behavior of the other depending on their personal threshold for conformity. With each additional person, the gumption, whatever the fuck a gumption is, required to break the cascade increases. To break the cascade, someone who is more brave and willing to look silly by checking the door than anyone else in the crowd so far must arrive. And I think we all have seen that as well. But I think it also just really makes sense. When I come to such a door and I see people standing in front of it, outside of a room, I do also assume that, you know, maybe there are, maybe the professor or whomever it is about isn't even there yet, you know, and therefore they're waiting outside. But I think it also really depends on the context. It depends on, obviously, whether you know those people or you don't. And I guess the chances are quite high, the chances are higher the more people we have. So, of course, I mean, if it is two people and they do not know themselves, then, you know, this might happen. But the more people there are that maybe know themselves, and the probability is quite high then that they talk to themselves and or talk to each and another and are like, well, what is going on, you know, should we actually check, should we actually do something about that, and probably then do something about that and then start this whole cascade of doing something, actually doing something. But still quite interesting. In 1393, well, that's definitely not fucking 1393, but in 1939, what the fuck? Man ranked mutual attraction love as the fourth most desirable trait in a wife, and women ranked it fifth in a husband. What? Mutual attraction and love. The most important trait? Women said they wanted dependable character in their partners, and men said they wanted emotional stability in theirs. When the same research was repeated in 1977, mutual attraction and love has risen to number one for both men and women, which is interesting. 1939, what the fuck? Depending on where this study was done, war might be of relevance. The Second World War, if I'm not dumb now, you know. But it is still interesting. And then saying dependable character, knowing that somebody is gonna do something and I can trust in this person, which I don't know. I would actually say that mutual attraction and love, when I love somebody, and when I'm attracted to somebody and I know this person also loves me, I think then there is some dependency already, or like I can depend on that person because I know this person loves me, or at least I can be a bit surer. If this is in case of everything, you know, in any scenario, probably not really. But yeah, the only way to win a debate is to avoid changing one's own mind. Only the loser of a debate learns anything new. Yeah, definitely. Always start by asking yourself why you want to change the other person's mind. Ask yourself, why is this important to you? And whatever your answer, ask again and again. Then share your answers with the other person. What? Always start by asking yourself why you want to change the other person's mind, and then ask yourself, why is this important to you? Whatever you answer, ask again and again, and then share your answers with the other person. If I could produce a device right now, something like a button on a glass case, and I told you that if you flipped open the glass and pressed the button, you would change your mind on this subject, would you press it? No, I wouldn't. Why does transport persuade us so? Because it can eliminate counter-arguing. When we are engaged with the story, we don't prepare a repetual because we feel swept up. Story isn't trying to change your mind. Narrative transport is that feeling when you become so fully immersed in a story that you forget yourself for a moment. For narrative transport to take place, a story must contain three features. The first one being a component that keeps your attention from wandering. Then the second one is a component that consistently evokes strong emotional reactions. And the third one, a component that evokes mental imagery. Strong emotions. I just, you know, immediately thought about sadness. Sad books, sad stories, sad things. Maybe this is actually one of the reasons why. And I might really be wrong there. Coming back to movies and coming back to the very, very first second of this episode. This might be actually a reason why sad movies tend to be quite good, maybe. Because we're having a story that probably has those three components. And therefore also creates this feeling of immersion, which apparently is good. But yeah, it would actually be interesting to know whether this is like, you know, the first component being actually the most important one and the third the least, or if, you know, they are all equally important, or, well, if I could say when I'm having like 90% of one component that I can just, you know, take 5% and 5% and then everything is fine. But yeah, when they employed deep canvassing without sharing their personal narratives, it no longer had any impact, while identical conversations that included storytelling still worked incredibly well. It didn't matter if the stories you share about the topic are your own or someone else's, only that if that it evolves someone affected by the issue at hand. Even sharing a video of someone else telling a story was effective, but removing this exchange from deep canvassing also removed all of its persuasive power. Beliefs and doubts are better thought of a process and not possessions. Neurons delivering a sensation of confidence. When the employed deep canvassing without the show, blah, 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 still, it didn't matter if the stories you share about the topic are your own some or someone else's, only that it evolves someone affected by the issue at hand. Which, I don't know, as I'm thinking about it, and this is actually quite an interesting realization. Stories, of course, have always been like a central part of human life. We talk a lot of, or we share a lot of stories. We invent a lot of stories. We are stories. Sometimes we make up stories. Sometimes we like stories and to be true, whatever. Stories are quite big. But whenever I'm, or whenever one is telling a story. And I mean, this is now about, maybe this is just how I'm seeing things. Maybe this is just about how Society in the place where I'm living kind of maybe works, and maybe I'm just completely wrong once again. But when you're telling a story, or when you begin to tell a story, and there is no anchor quite, like out of the blue, you just start talking and you just, talk about this certain story that, that is just a story, it's just a random story, but there is no anchor in terms of. There was nothing previously in the conversation that can be tied to the story, and there is nothing in terms of personal connections that other people might be having with the stories, unless by coincidence. But we are going for this complete lack for this factor as well. Then I would just assume, and I would say that this is not a really good story in terms of one should not tell it. Because people might think like, well, why did you just, bring up the story? Why is this important? On the other hand, though, when there is an anchor and when there is like a person that that is affected by, the issue at hand, or by the issue that the story might be about, or by whatever kind of anchor, whatever kind of similarity there is in the story, then I think it is a good story, and then I think it is a really good one to share, and then the response from the people that you're telling the story to, so friends, family, whomever, is probably going to be a really good one, and it does not feel out of place. Yeah, this is what I'm essentially willing to say. It does not feel out of place because, there might be some anchor, there might be something that has a connection to the story, and might be actually important to therefore talk about stories and share stories that are deeply connected with the audience, but maybe also kind of completely the opposite, or just playing with it, having one story that is just, really not resonating with them, but, maybe just on the very back of the story and very end of the story just begins to make sense or something. I don't know. Just some realization, just some thoughts. Let's see. When the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded in 1986, psychologist, I think it is Ulrich Neisser, had his class of 106 people write down how they heard, where they were, what they were doing, and what they felt. 2.5 years later, he asked them these questions again, and only 10% got them all right. But the interesting thing is not that their memories were faulty, it is that they refused to accept that their memories could be faulty. Even after looking at their own journals and seeing the truth, one student told Neisser, "That is my handwriting, but that is not what happened." When neurologist Robert Burton read about that study, he became fascinated with the very idea of certainty itself. He wrote a book on a topic titled On Being Certain, which is actually, not that fun to read, to be honest. Which just implies that I think quite often we should not be too certain. And we do not actually know. I mean, when it comes to memories, and maybe also challenging those memories and realizing that we should challenge those memories because they might just plainly be wrong. Maybe also when it comes to traumas and having those memories and believing in those memories, but therefore then realizing that those memories are maybe just made up by my head, and maybe by the way that I'm feeling about things, which, yeah, might then exaggerate things.